Okay, now we have Mr. Trepanim, Dr. Trepanim, Jeff Kosner's here. He's going to talk to us about all things syphilis. Has anybody seen a case of syphilis? It's so rare. I don't even know why we even bother to discuss it. I mean, it's amazing not only how many cases there are, but how the clinical presentation is changing in much more neurosyphilis and eye and all that kind of stuff. So we separated that out this time so that we could get a strong focus on that, and we don't contaminate the STI talks with syphilis in that kind of way. Anyway, Jeff is a professor of medicine and public health at UCLA, who has a great fight song that they stole from Cal, and wonderful to have you here.
All right, thank you very much. Well, it took me a couple decades to become relevant, so I'm glad to be able to share an update on clinical management of syphilis with you. I call this talk The Great Imitator Revealed, Syphilis. I have received royalties from McGraw-Hill for a textbook called Current Diagnosis and Management of STDs and Walter Cooler's, which is the up-to-date on disseminated gonococcal infection. So after today's presentation, we'll learn the differential diagnosis of an anogenital ulcer, the preferred treatment for syphilis by stage, and at least three means of syphilis prevention. And then I'll be hosting the workshop later. So for those of you who have complicated cases or any cases whatsoever, be happy to go over those with you in that group. So we'll start off with a 44-year-old man with a new painless lesion near his anus. He had a new sex partner about 2 weeks ago, and you can see the gloved hands of the examiner. And this kind of raised lesion, mildly erythematous base, but as I mentioned, non-tender. So when we think about an anogenital lesion, we want to think about STDs like primary syphilis, genital herpes. They're typically tender, however. Chancroid, which is particularly rare in the United States, but would also be tender in a more erythematous base. But there are other things that cause genital ulcers, which we see, such as fixed drug reactions, particularly to drugs like doxycycline or non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. There can be staph or strep infections, autoimmune conditions like Behçet's disease, occasional trauma, and malignancy. So in the vanishing practice of dark field microscopy, which we still used to do at San Francisco City Clinic, we would take a sample from this lesion, look under the dark field microscope, and we would see these beautiful swimming treponemes, and we feel very satisfied that we made a diagnosis of primary syphilis. And as mentioned, syphilis is caused by Treponema pallidum, subspecies pallidum. So there are occasionally other subspecies out there, particularly from your patients from Central America or South America, who could also have a positive syphilis test, but it wouldn't be caused by the agent of syphilis. So other lesions, and all these are dark field positive. This is from my San Francisco City Clinic collection. So they all can be easily misdiagnosed as genital herpes or potentially chancroid. The one on your lower right, you can see these small kind of punctate lesions around the urethra, but again, dark field positive. And the one on your lower left, that's fairly typical location for a primary chancre. So particularly in uncircumcised males, it's important to roll back the foreskin and take a look at that area of the coronal sulcus. All right, so question number one, what is the best treatment in this case? Amoxicillin for 10 days, benzathine 2.4 million units once, benzathine 2.4 times 3, doxycycline, or ceftriaxone. All right, excellent. So 84% agreed that primary syphilis or syphilis less than 1 year duration should be treated according to CDC STD treatment guidelines with a single injection of benzathine. And some people did say three. Some people still believe early syphilis and HIV-infected individuals should be treated with three doses. But the current recommendations are, regardless of HIV status, in early syphilis, which is less than 1 year duration, which is primary, secondary, or early latent, a single dose is sufficient. It's also important to remember about prophylaxis. So any partners that may have been exposed in the past 90 days, those individuals should get prophylaxed with a single injection of penicillin G benzathine. And it's important not to rely on the test result from that patient, from that partner. So what you're trying to do is prevent or abort the infection. So once that partner has a positive test, they've already been infected. So you're trying to treat the exposure to prevent infection. So do not fall to the argument from that partner, well, let's get the test and then see what the test result is, and if I'm positive, I'll go to treatment. The partner is supposed to be treated before they develop a positive test. And it is the duty of every physician and medical provider in all 50 states to make a reasonable effort to notify partners. So most of us rely on our health department partners, but health departments have been defunded. They've lost staff. They do not have the same resources they had 10 to 20 years ago. And law says that providers must make a reasonable effort to notify partners. So these are some data from a randomized controlled trial looking at azithromycin in Tanzania. I don't want to confuse people. Azithromycin is not recommended, but this just shows you that a single dose of benzathine penicillin in both HIV-infected and uninfected patients had a high efficacy, so 95% cure rate at 9 months of follow-up. So this is a second case. This is a 24-year-old male with a new onset of rash on his chest and back. Recently started on antiretroviral therapy, ABC, 3TC, and DTG, and has had one regular partner. This is what the rash looks like, so fairly nonspecific macular papular lesions on the anterior chest and on the back. And then when you examine the hands, you see these kind of classic erythematous, a little bit copper-colored lesions on the palms and the soles. And certainly when you see this, you're thinking about syphilis. But there are a variety of other conditions that occasionally can be confused with secondary syphilis, particularly viral exanthemas and acute HIV infection, pityriasis rosea, drug eruptions, rarely lichen planus, psoriasis, sarcoid. But when you see a palmar plantar rash, it's going to be secondary syphilis, unless for some reason they've developed erythema multiforme, a progressive hypersensitivity reaction, or they're an adolescent living in eastern part of the south when being exposed and infected with Rocky Mountain spotted fever. So additionally, other secondary lesions in syphilis are lesions around the angle of the mouth. So this could be easily misdiagnosed as oral herpes labialis, but this is what we call a split papule. This is a secondary or wet lesion. These are particularly infectious. Hair loss, so people will complain of hair on their pillow and patchy loss of hair. You also see these condyloma telata, which shouldn't be confused with condyloma acuminata, which are the raised verrucous lesions of HPV. But these are the wet lesions of syphilis, what we consider highly infectious, and the textbook will say that a wet prep of these will be teeming with spirochetes. And then on the bottom, you see these oral white plaque lesions, which most of us would readily diagnose as thrush, or oral hairy leukoplakia, but these are secondary lesions of syphilis called mucus patches, and these are also highly infectious. So these will help you appreciate why syphilis can be easily transmitted by oral sex, particularly in someone in this secondary stage. So you do your serological testing on this case with the rash. His RPR comes back at 1 to 16. He's TPPA positive. So question number two is, what is the best treatment for this individual? Amoxicillin, benzathine times one, benzathine times three, doxycycline for 14 days, or doxycycline for 28 days. All right, well, I thought we'd be getting in a kind of higher level of correctness with the answer, but the answer is still a single dose of benzathine penicillin G. That this is secondary syphilis. This is usually acquired within the past year, usually in the past 6 months, and the CDC STD treatment guidelines are a single injection of benzathine penicillin G. We used 3 injections when someone has unknown duration of infection. We don't know that they've been infected for less than a year. Or if someone has latent infection, if they've been infected for more than a year. Doxycycline, 100 milligrams twice a day, is an alternative. So in someone who is non-pregnant and penicillin allergic, that's actually not unreasonable. And 28 days would be too long for cases of secondary syphilis, which is early syphilis or recently acquired. So again, the treatment of choice for secondary syphilis is benzathine penicillin G. And notify partners, in this case, up to 6 months. Because for secondary syphilis, they've progressed now from their primary syphilis to their secondary syphilis, and on average, it takes about 6 months. And the CDC recommendations are to do partner elicitation and notification up to 6 months. So now I'm going to switch a little bit to the epidemiology. We heard from Dr. Rutkowski that STD rates are skyrocketing, syphilis rates are on the rise, and particularly syphilis rises sharply among newborns. So this was an analysis we recently looked at, the number of cases of primary and secondary syphilis in the United States since 1956. And you can see there was a steady and high rate in the 50s through the 80s, and then an increase in the late 80s, we think, associated with the crack cocaine epidemic, increase in transactional sex, increased numbers of partners and core groups, and then a dramatic decline with the advent of AIDS, and fear of AIDS and changes in sexual behavior. And then in about 2000, the CDC announced it was going to eliminate syphilis. And this was the fourth elimination campaign in the history of the United States. And we're actually fairly optimistic. However, since 2000, we've seen a steady resurgence that now we're at the highest rate of syphilis in over 25 years. And our current understanding is we say it's multifactorial, has to do with increases in sexual risk behavior, the decreased fear of AIDS, substantial declines in condom use, both in adults and in adolescents, and also a substantial decline in our public health prevention services. So many counties and jurisdictions where the action happens at the local level do not have staff anymore to do follow-up, do not support prevention and education campaigns, and are not really doing much to promote testing in the target populations. And this just shows you the primary and secondary cases. And these are probably the most important cases to follow because these are recently acquired. So these are acquired in the past 6 months. And you can see a substantial increase, almost a doubling in men who have sex with men, but also importantly an increase in heterosexual men and in women. And unfortunately, that rise in women has translated to an increase in babies born with congenital syphilis. And unfortunately, I hail from the state of California, which we usually hold out as a success in many of our public health programs. We have among the highest number of cases of babies born with syphilis in the United States, as well as states in the Southeast. And a lot of this has to do, again, with the de-evolution and loss of local public health capacity. So while providers may be doing testing, those test results that are positive are not going and ending up being picked up by the safety net of public health. People may not be learning about their test result. They may not be coming back for treatment. And we don't have the support staff at the local level to make sure that people are treated in a timely fashion. So I'm going to move to a third case. This is a 32-year-old HIV-infected male. He's on highly active retroviral therapy for 2 years. He's been virologically suppressed. He's new to your office, and his RPR is reactive at 1 to 32. His TPPA is reactive, and he's asymptomatic without any lesions or rash. So the question is, how would you stage this case? And being able to accurately stage syphilis is really a key aspect of being able to manage syphilis with confidence. So primary, secondary, latent early, late latent, or latent unknown duration. All right, about 80%, right? So this is latent, right? No symptoms whatsoever, no signs, no lesions, no sores. Unknown duration, so I just gave you one titer. So I didn't say how long he's had this positive titer, so you don't know if it's just been a few months or you didn't know if it's been a couple years. Many of you probably do know that you can call your county public health department or your state public health department, and occasionally it'll be staffed on the odd day of the week that someone will answer the phone. And then when you get them on the phone, they have what's called the syphilis reactor registry. And in the reactor registry, if you give the name and the date of birth of the patient, they can actually look up and tell you if they have any prior positive reports. And that can help you tremendously to know, okay, is this 1 to 16 actually a decline because they were seen at the SED clinic 3 months ago and they're 1 to 64? Or do they have a 1 to 1 9 months ago, and this is a fourfold increase? So knowing who to call, when to call, and developing a relationship with that service in your local jurisdiction is really important. And you should make sure that number is available and you utilize that service if it's available. So we have this case of latent unknown duration. What is the best treatment? Amoxicillin, benzathine once, benzathine times 3, doxycycline 14 days, and doxycycline for 28 days. All right, woo! All right. Give yourself a round of applause. All right. 94%. I challenge the other faculty to get to a 94% in the audience response. So well done. So if they've had syphilis for a year or more, or you don't know how long they've had syphilis, you need to treat them with 3 injections, because syphilis is a very slow-growing organism, right? You have regular bacteria like E. coli, which double every 20 minutes. You have M. tuberculosis, which doubles on the order of days to weeks. And syphilis is kind of in between there. So you need a very long, protracted, but low level of antibiotic to fully eradicate the organism. All right, so injectable penicillin G is the treatment of choice for latent syphilis unknown duration. So also we've had and we've heard about stockouts and shortages of bicillin penicillin G. So we would appreciate us. Actually, Dr. Thompson and I have an advocacy call with Pfizer this Friday. If any of you had any experiences with stockouts, shortages, high prices, difficulty getting bicillin with your patients saying, oh, I can't afford it, I'll have to go to the health department, or if you don't stock it or have it and you refer your patients to the health department, it really would be helpful if you'd write that down on a question card and share that with us. So as I mentioned, latent syphilis, this is what it looks like. It's blank. There's no signs or symptoms that you're going to see. So in order to diagnose latent syphilis, you have to be familiar with the syphilis tests. And so we'll take you through med school or nursing school again and review that there are the non-treponemal tests, the RPR or the VDRL, and that detects antibody to cardiolipin. This is the antibody that goes up and down with treatment over time, and we consider it clinically significant when there's a fourfold increase from 1 to 2 to 1 to 8, or a fourfold decline from 1 to 16, from 1 to 64 to 1 to 16. It's highly specific, but not 100% specific, so there can be false positives in injection drug users, people with autoimmune conditions, people who have been recently vaccinated. Now, we have a more specific test. Sometimes we consider the confirmatory test, known as a treponemal test. the TPPA, the FDA Absorb, the TPEIA, which is an automated test, and the rapid treponemal test, which is an FDA-approved test you can use in your clinic as a rapid 10-minute assay to detect treponemal antibody. And this detects antibody to treponemal antigen. So it's a recombinant antigen that's synthesized into the test system. It's more sensitive, actually. It becomes positive earlier than the RPR. So in my practice, if I see a patient where I'm suspecting primary syphilis, I will order both tests to make sure that I have the best chance of making a serological confirmation. And this is the test that remains positive. So I have 85% because sometimes it can seroreverse and become seronegative, particularly if you treat someone early. But generally, this is the test that remains positive for life. And this is the test, like a measles antibody or hepatitis A antibody, indicates past or current infection. All right, another case. This is a 44-year-old HIV-infected female. Occasionally exchanges sex for money or drugs. She complains of 1 week of a headache, ringing in her right ear with some hearing loss. Her RPR is 1 to 16. Her TPPA is reactive. So the question is how strongly do you agree or disagree that a CSF analysis is necessary in this young woman with hearing loss and ringing in her ear and a positive syphilis titer? All right, so 66% strongly agreed, some moderately agreed. So there's, you know, it's always complicated to get a CSF analysis, either perform the LP or refer someone to LP. But the CDC SCD treatment guidelines do say indications for CSF analysis include any neurologic findings in someone with syphilis, which would be any ocular findings, visual loss, uveitis, inflammation of the eye, any type of auditory findings, and those are the most two common areas that generally we see in neurosyphilis. Neurosyphilis can also cause a meningular vascular syndrome and cause strokes. It can also cause a meningitis, but the most common actually we see are different manifestations of ocular syphilis, and the primary complaint will be people have a red eye or vision loss, and then sometimes they can complain of hearing loss. So someone with neurological findings, it is indicated to get CSF analysis. Someone who has tertiary disease, if they have dementia, aortic involvement, or gamma. And then it's a little bit subtle, but someone has treatment failure. So if you're treating someone HIV uninfected with early syphilis and they haven't had a fourfold decline by 6 months, and you have a suspicion for treatment failure, you've ruled out reinfection, which is a common cause of persistent titers or rising titers, then it may be indicated to do a CSF analysis because the CSF can serve as a sanctuary for untreated infection. And what the CSF analysis helps you do, it helps you rule out other conditions, and it gives you a baseline. So you know, based on that CSF titer or the inflammatory markers or the protein, when you repeat the CSF in 6 months, has there been significant improvement? And unfortunately, people with hearing loss or ocular abnormalities and vision loss, there's still about 25 to 30% have some persistent deficits. So it is important to remember that while syphilis is curable, it can have serious consequences. All right, so the question is, what is the best treatment for neurosyphilis? Penicillin G times 14 days, IV, ceftriaxone times 10 days IV, doxycycline for 14 days, or IV penicillin for 14 days plus penicillin G benzathine on day 14. All right, so 70% said 14 days of IV penicillin is enough, and 26% recently read the CDC SCD treatment guidelines and said, oh, I know the guidelines say that experts recommend either 1 to 3 doses at the cessation of IV therapy, because the feeling is that it's possible that there may be some lingering organism there. Remember, it's a slow growing organism, and most people do not get neurosyphilis, so maybe there's some immune defect, maybe there's something unusual, and the experts recommend that after 14 days you give an additional 1 to 3 doses. So most people forget that. I would say it's not common practice, and as evidenced by this survey, we can see that. But that is the recommendation, to get the additional shot on the way or out the door after the completion of IV therapy. So there's some unique things about syphilis and HIV infection that we've seen over the years, that people with HIV infection may be more likely to have multiple chancres, which sometimes can make the differential diagnosis a little bit more complicated. So you might think about herpes, but syphilitic chancres may be multiple, and also people may present with both chancre and a rash, or chancre and adenopathy, or chancre and fever at the same time. Generally, the serologies are normal and they react normally, but they can decline a little bit slower, and we don't really know if that's due to HIV infection, immune suppression, or prior history of syphilis. But because of that, our outcome timelines for treatment success are a little bit more extended. So someone with HIV and early syphilis, we determine treatment success at 12 months. With someone with latent syphilis or unknown duration syphilis, we can actually wait to 24 months before we determine the outcome of therapy. And there is an increased risk of neurosyphilis. About 2 to 3% of HIV-infected individuals who get syphilis can have some neurological involvement. And this was some data years ago that we had put together showing that in untreated individuals, syphilis can increase the viral load and decrease CD4 count. These studies have been replicated in people who have been suppressed and actually do not show as dramatic of change. It still can occur, and people who do have some viral load increases, you should obviously ascertain about adherence and drug-drug interactions, but you may want to think about other systemic infections. And if they're at risk, consider syphilis. So now I want to move my last 4.5 minutes to prevention. So we think about prevention at the individual level. We want to reduce exposure, which is basically reducing the number of sex partners, reduce the risk of infection after exposure, which is that prophylactic penicillin in the partners, reduce the sequelae of infection, so treat it early to prevent the long-term sequelae. Untreated syphilis, the old textbooks say about 25% can develop tertiary syphilis and end-stage problems, general paresis of the insane, become elected to the United States presidency. And then at the population level, What we're focused on the population level is the reproductive number. So that's the number of new infections that are caused by one case. And to affect that, we really want to reduce the duration of infection. So the CDC, since 1937, has really had the same strategy of screening, treatment, and partner services. And that strategy was first put forth by Thomas Perrin. It's supported by the CDC through grants to states and grants to major cities, but it's really implemented by your local health department. And it's a local health department where the rubber meets the road that makes the action happen. So if that local health department does not have the resources, not going to be much be able to be done about the prevention and control of syphilis. Screening recommendations for syphilis from the SCD treatment guidelines, which has now been echoed by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, are in pregnancy, and make sure in high prevalence areas to repeat syphilis testing in third trimester, in men who have sex with men at least every year, and in those with certain risk factors such as multiple partners, meaning partners online or in sex venues, have sex with conjunction with illicit drug use, important to get more frequent testing. And that's probably the best thing we can do for our patients in our clinical setting, is just every time they get a blood test, do another test for syphilis. This was some of the campaigns I was involved with in the early 2000s in San Francisco. So very effective campaigns, very sex-positive messaging about syphilis education, about getting tested, about the 7-foot penis marching in the Pride Parade. And this actually generated higher rates of syphilis testing among the target population. So it's proven to be highly effective. In Australia, they've also had nice evidence that more frequent testing can lead to reduction in secondary syphilis. So if you think about it, if you can reduce that very early syphilis, primary or secondary, by reducing the duration of infection at the population level, you should be able to see a decline in that incident syphilis or primary or secondary, and that's indeed what they saw in Australia with more frequent syphilis testing. Lastly, very exciting and innovative is the use of chemoprophylaxis or doxycycline for the prevention of syphilis acquisition in men who have sex with men. And this was a pilot study I did with folks at the Los Angeles LGBT Center. And we found that those who took doxycycline 100 milligrams a day had a 73% reduction over the next year in the acquisition of syphilis. 73% reduction in the acquisition of syphilis, and was found to be safe and well-tolerated. Our French colleagues, the same J.M. Molina, who brought you Ypergay and on-demand PrEP, did on-demand doxy for syphilis prophylaxis, and he recommended in his cohort 200 milligrams after sex and found the same 73% reduction in syphilis acquisition. So now there are further trials going on with partnerships out of UCSF, University of Washington, British Columbia, and in Australia, and we're hoping for additional evidence to replicate the efficacy and show additional safety data. So in summary, most important thing you do to be effective management of syphilis is to think syphilis. Screen, treat patients quickly, treat their partners, and rescreen. Prevention does work, as I showed you, but it has to be funded, and doxycycline prophylaxis is highly promising. So thank you very much.
Great job. Couple of quick questions, mostly related to some of the things you just showed. So if we, two things really, for us, a lot of our patients with HIV are suppressed and are coming back every 6 months, but it sounds like they almost need to come in every 3 months to get syphilis screening. Have you implemented that in your HIV clinic?
The question is how to increase syphilis screening among patients we're only seeing every 6 months for HIV care. And the short answer is no, we have not implemented that. But at least in Los Angeles, there's a lot of community-based programs and community-based organizations where people often go for their syphilis testing. So we remind them they only need to see us every 6 months, but they can go to other community sites for more frequent testing. There's really no reason, though, that they shouldn't be able to have a drop-in visit for a syphilis test.
Right. Yeah. And one other quick thing: a lot of your data are pretty impressive in terms of reduction with doxycycline. And the flip side, everyone says, what about resistance? Not just to maybe potentially for treponema pallidum, but for other STIs. Have you seen that in gonorrhea or other things?
All right. Well, I went out with Shelley Gorbach, who was the editor of CID for decades, and now he's retired and he's in his mid-80s. He lives in sunny Los Angeles. And I asked him that specific question, and he said, "Bah, humbug." So he completely dismissed it. He said tetracyclines have been available since the 1950s. We've never seen any resistance to T. pallidum, the agent of syphilis. We've not seen any resistance to chlamydia trachomatis. We have seen persistent resistance to Neisseria gonorrhea, but we don't use tetracyclines for the management of Neisseria gonorrhea. So he knows that doxycycline has been used for prophylaxis for lots of other infectious diseases, and he actually thought it was a good idea.
Okay, sounds like he's living in London in the 1800s. Okay, let's go here.
Hi. I'm Sally Cooper. I'm in Okaloosa County in Florida, actually the medical director of our health department there. And while I cannot speak for the health departments in California, nor even in the rest of Florida, I will say that we are absolutely, despite funding issues, testing and treating syphilis, tracking down partners. Our nurses are following those RPRs and getting them repeat testing for HIV at the same time they're repeating those RPRs as well. So can't speak for everybody, but it's being done in Little Okaloosa County. So my question My question was actually from my colleague sitting next to me, which she asked me when I was mumbling about health departments under my breath. This database for syphilis patients, she asked if it's nationwide. And I know that our local counties can certainly call our health department and we can tell them what's going on locally, maybe even at a state level. But I wasn't aware of a nationwide database, and I just wanted to put that question out there.
Yeah, so that syphilis reactive registry is not national. It usually exists at the county and state level. So the county is reported up to the state. So some counties that don't have the staff, like you're blessed to have, people do have to reach to the state level.
Right. Thank you.
Just a quick question about the problem with pregnancy, HIV, and a new positive RPR, positive FTA. It's a pain in the neck to watch, take care of these women, and the titer won't go down, and they're pregnant. And I've seen them get retreated. Do you have any advice or comments about that situation?
Well, I mean, there's two issues with the management of syphilis and pregnancy. One is obviously you want to protect and prevent mother-child transmission in the fetus, and there's good evidence that even a single dose of benzathine penicillin given prior to the last 4 weeks of pregnancy is highly effective to that. So I think if they've gotten at least one shot, you can feel comfortable that you're going to prevent mother-child transmission. In the mother, I mean, sometimes because of the hyperimmune state, you just may have to wait until the pregnancy is over to really see that fourfold decline. But if there's been no additional exposures and the woman is serofast and she's been adequately treated, I think, you know, we just have to feel comfortable that, you know, there's not ongoing infection.
Yeah, so following up that a little bit, what is your, they said, spiel to people who are serofast?
Right, so serofast is the situation where after treatment people still have a persistently positive titer, and there's been good reports that that persistently positive titer usually is a low titer, so it's 1 to 8 or less. So a persistently positive titer of 1 to 16 or 1 to 32 or greater would be highly suspicious for either persistent infection, treatment failure, or re-exposure. But people with serofast, about 10 to 20% of people, after treatment will have a low positive titer. And remember that titer, 1 to 2, can bounce around. So it can be 1 to 4, it can be 1 to 1, and that's really not indicative of a new infection, but just a persistent serofast.
So that's exactly the next question. A patient had a titer of 1 to 2 for 3 years, and now it's 1 to 64. Is that recrudescent infection, or is that a new infection?
Yeah, so you know, moving from 1 to 2 to 1 to 64 is a more than fourfold increase, so that would be consistent with a new infection, new exposure, and depending on the timing between that, that would either be treated as early, less than 1 year, or as unknown with three shots.
Yep. What about patients who have neurosyphilis and they become asymptomatic with treatment? Do you follow up with an LP at any point?
So the CDC recommendation is if you've done an LP at baseline to do an LP 6 to 12 months later and have documentation that they've had improvement. Now, if that initial LP was completely normal or negative, there's no indication for repeat.
What do you do with patients who you schedule for three shots of penicillin and they start stretching it out and not showing up?
Right. So
If that ever happens.
So the recommendation is to go not more than 14 days between doses. And if people do go more than 14 days, the recommendation is to restart the three-dose therapy. And for some reason, if it's still becoming problematic, I would personally consider switching to doxycycline. And perhaps that may be something maybe more adherent with in the long term.
Okay. Some people suggest that treponemapalium EIA is the best test for early syphilis for folks who weren't infected before, and it appears earlier than RPR. Comment.
Yeah, so I mentioned that in slide 22, that the treponemal antibody test is more sensitive and can rise earlier than the RPR. So if you are, you know, considering the diagnosis of syphilis, I do recommend getting both tests. And a lot of places have moved to what's called the reverse algorithm, where their screening process will be done with a treponemal test, and if that's reactive, it'll go to an RPR. That works well in a syphilis-naive population, but in a population where people have been infected and have a positive treponemal test, it's not helpful.
That actually was the next question, so thank you for that. And then, no kidding. And then, can you speak about prozone phenomena? We see that anymore with the current testing?
I feel like Johnny Carson, right? So Johnny Carson with the,
yes.
You know, the
Karnak.
Right, Karnak.
Yeah.
So prozone reaction definitely occurs. The prozone reaction is when there's too much antibody essentially in that serum specimen and it fails to make the required lattice structure that the RPR detects to determination of positivity. So the way we deal with a prozone reaction is we dilute it 1 to 10 and then we repeat the RPR and then that should be positive. We don't really see that with the treponemal test, so that's another reason why you may want to make sure you're ordering both tests. And if you do suspect it is prozone, which would give you a false negative, you have to go back to the laboratory and you say, I suspect this, please dilute it 1 to 10.
One question here on clarity about neurosyphilis treatment. The 14 days of IV followed by the benzathine, what you mean is as they're leaving the hospital or wherever, you give them a shot of benzathine. You don't give them it daily for 14 more days.
That is right. So benzathine is a very long-acting medication. That's why we give it, 7 to 14 days. So you only have to give it one shot on the way at the hospital or if they're getting their IV at home when they come back to see you for their 14-day evaluation.
Okay. So this is a little complicated, but the patient, and we'll get into some of these in the workshop, of course, but a patient who had latent syphilis, who had an allergy to penicillin, so I guess had an allergy to doxy as well. Not sure how often that happens. What would be your next agent, tetracycline or something else?
Right. Well, presumably you couldn't get tetracycline if they have an allergy to doxycycline. So you have options. You can try to desensitize, and that's probably what would be in the CDC recommendations is to desensitize to penicillin, which can be done. You could potentially desensitize to your tetracycline. Your third option might be a third-generation cephalosporin like ceftriaxone. And currently there is one ongoing clinical trial looking at cefixime as an alternative, and hopefully in the next year or two we'll see evidence for additional agents to treat syphilis.
And we'll finish with a softball over the middle of the plate because I know what you're doing now, but is there any thought about a vaccine for syphilis?
All right, so there's definitely a couple groups, University of Washington, University of Connecticut, and UCLA, who are embarking on a vaccine development program. Vaccines is definitely heavy lifting, so it takes a lot of resources, big investment. But now with this resurgence in syphilis, NIH has funded a few different investigators to start looking at what the immunological characteristics that might be required to develop either a sterilizing vaccine or a disease-preventing vaccine. Because if we can create a disease-preventing vaccine, we can actually have a public health vaccine that would prevent transmission because people only spread when they have disease. So I think that is actually may actually be more tenable and more achievable than actually a sterilizing vaccine to prevent infection.
Great. Last question, very quickly.
Yeah, hi. Alex Gonzalez, Fenway Health in Boston. So we have about like one neurosyphilis case with our HIV patients every 30 or 60 days. And our usual MO is to give the bicillin shot first, and then, line up whatever needs to happen for the neurosyphilis to be treated, like get insurance approval, do the LP as an outpatient, get them set up with their PICC line. Is there any significance to giving the shot at the beginning of the 14-day course or at the end or, 3 days before, as long as they get a shot?
Right. So it's actually a fairly innovative idea to give the shot that day. But within 24 hours, you're going to reduce infectiousness. So that's an important intervention in and of itself as a in terms of public health. But we give the shot at 14 days to benefit the individual clinically because we think they need at least 3 to 4 weeks of penicillin therapy. That we're actually treating them like a late latent infection by giving them longer duration of therapy because for whatever reason, their immune system or maybe the organism, which has been suggested in some studies, is a little bit different in this case of neurosyphilis. And the expert thought is they need a longer duration of penicillin therapy, 3 to 4 weeks.
Great. Thank you. You already have one of these?
I'll take it. Thank you.
Okay, great. All right, so we're passing the syphilis on to the syphilis expert.